The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Appreciate being invited to speak with you today, and we're going to talk about the rapidly changing financial markets both in the U.S. and abroad. When I began working 25 years ago, the environment was very different than it is today. Exchanges were much more like utilities, and actually I sometimes get, well, a lot of people frown when I say it, but they really were more like country clubs. They were built for the members, and like a country club, the members get to decide what services that the club is going to provide, and the business itself isn't really a business. It's there for the benefit of the members. They weren't public companies, and they were primarily, again, I said membership organizations, but controlled by a few very powerful brokerage firms on Wall Street. Those same firms are now our very powerful customers, but it's a very different organization today from what it was when I, the markets were from what they were when I started. Before I talk about what we're here to learn today, I'd like to take a few minutes to look back and give you some of my thoughts on how and why exchanges are where they are today. And I think the easiest way for me to do that is to talk about the exchange that I founded, Archipelago. The creation of Archipelago and other companies like it contributed to many of the changes, and I'd say significantly contributed to the changes that we see today. And then from there, I'll fast forward to focus on three broad areas that are impacting our markets today. And the first is the trend towards consolidation of both our domestic markets and markets abroad. The second is the transformation of the New York Stock Exchange and its recently completed merger with Euronext, which is creating the world's first global exchange. And third, the strength of the U.S. financial markets in general and the competition for global capital. And since this really should be an open exchange, we're going to save time for some. I think we'll wait till the end to have questions, unless somebody has something that's so compelling that you want to do it. You want to do it at the moment. I'd be happy to answer those as well. So, getting back to Archipelago, ARCA was founded, and we call it ARCA around the office. Was founded in January of 1997, and when it was started, it was an ECN, which stands for Electronic Communications Network. And the way that business got started, I had, after being fired from one of the jobs that you mentioned I was fired from, decided that I could do this on my own. And then I would have just as I said to my wife when I told her about my great idea that I was going to start my own business. I said, Sharon, you know, I think I can screw this up on my own as easily as anybody else can mess things up for me. So I decided to go out on my own. I mortgaged my house just so we had some money to live on. And I started a broker-dealer called Terra Nova Trading. And it was really designed to be an institutional brokerage firm, one that dealt with mutual fund companies and hedge funds, which is what my customer base was at the time. But while this company got started, things were changing in the U.S. stock markets. It was as a result primarily of the crash in 1987. Because of the heavy volumes, investors were denied access to the markets. The telephones were busy because that's how we were doing business, was always over what at the time was exclusively over the telephone or on the floor, and you can only get so much volume in at one time. In that way, the SEC mandated that there be better access, and the simple way to solve that problem was to provide some electronic access to the market. So this was evolving. Naturally, the markets resisted that electronic access because the benefit of being a member or being inside the club if you will, was that you had access to special information that others didn't have access to, and you had access to the market because you were at the point of sale in the market, in the case of the floor of the exchange, that others didn't have. But the SEC, in looking out for investors, which is what its job is, said we're going to have to solve this problem, and the way to do it was clearly by providing electronic access. So as this is going on after the crash and, you know, hearings in Congress and all of this is happening to try and decide what to do with the problem, I started this small broker-dealer. And it had I had no idea that it was going to go in the direction that it went in, but I got it going. I had enough of a customer base that I thought I could keep the lights on, and I figured I'd just see what happened, and if I saw an opportunity, I would take it. So as that business got going, I met a couple, Stuart and Margaret Townsend, and they owned a technology company. They built financial quotation software. They were based in Chicago, and I started to do some business with them. I would give their trading system to customers of Terranova in exchange for doing business with us. And as that went on, and we started to find out that individuals, at the time my primary focus was on institutions, but individuals was where the real demand was. Individual traders wanted to be able to get access to the markets, and simply there was no great way in, although the SEC had mandated that this new connectivity would be put in place. So as you know, it naturally, as I'm trying to get this business going and looking for a place to take it, you go the path of least resistance. We opened up and started to do business with individual traders, and we had a better mousetrap. The thing worked great. Eventually, there was an application on the internet, and that business started to boom. I met with some of you earlier, and I think I'd mentioned at one point, and this is just an entrepreneur, a business owner's dream. And we used to have people that would fly in from all over the country, stand in line outside of our office to try and get an opportunity to say, you know, where can I get in line so that we can actually connect to you guys so we can trade. So as that business was rolling along, these new electronics that were put in place started to take hold. Retail investors were gaining better access, and the SEC took one very, very bold step. There was an economist. His name is Richard Lindsay, and he was the head of Market Reg. Traditionally, those folks are attorneys. And we had, in this brief period of time, someone who really understood markets and fair access and supply and demand and the way things work from that perspective, decided to launch on a new rule set. And it was to open up competition to the exchanges. So it was going to bring, initially, the competition was going to come for NASDAQ. Later on, it was going to come for the New York Stock Exchange. But this rule set came out. It was called the Order Handling Rules. And it was literally somewhere between 600 and 700 pages long. And because I was in this business of electronic trading and this thing was happening, I read those rules. Actually, I was sick. I had some sort of a virus that had me in bed for a couple of days. And I read these rules. And I read them the first time. And I had my highlighter out. And there was one section in particular that was really interesting to me. And that was this creation of electronic communication networks, or ECNs. It didn't really exist. There was InstaNet, which was an ECN, but not under this new format, which is really going to let you in the marketplace. So I read those rules, and I thought, wow, this would be the greatest thing if the customers of my firm, I would be able to give them this kind of access to the marketplace under these new rules. And a few, I know it's probably weeks after I had read that rule set, NASDAQ came to Chicago to talk to the broker-dealer community about what they were going to do to implement this new rule set. Because, again, it was really challenging NASDAQ at this point in time. New York, still big enough to keep the SEC off their back. They focused on NASDAQ. And I went to the meeting and sat in the audience, and there was a presenter. They came up and they talked about, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And at one point, they got to the Q&A, and I raised my hand and I said, you know, I read this section on ECNs, and my broker-dealer can have access to the NASDAQ stock market in this way because it's, there's, you know, you don't have a facility like this. Are you thinking about building in ECN, and the folks from NASDAQ said no. And I thought, well, guys, you know, that doesn't make any sense because there's a huge demand for this, and it doesn't seem fair. And this went on for a little bit. I mean, I wasn't being a pest, but I was like, you know, I don't understand why you wouldn't do this. And I won't mention his name, but a senior, he's not even there anymore, a senior executive of NASDAQ said to me, if you have a problem with this, why don't you write your congressman? So I sat there and I thought, you know what, the heck with you. If I have a problem with this, I'll go build one because this is the most obvious business opportunity that could be sitting right in front of you, and there's a rule now that's going to make it happen. It's not like, you know, this is coming out of left field. So I left that meeting, and I raced over to this friends of mine that I told you I was doing some business with that had the technology company in Chicago, and I said to Stuart, I said, Stuart, I've got this idea. I've read this rule, and if you want to go 50-50 with me in the business, you guys write the software. I'll put the business together, and I'll take care of the regulatory approval process. That's the deal. And he said, you know what? I'll do it. I actually think we have some people here that could build one of these things. And he, by the way, how long do we have? And I said, 8 weeks. He was like, God. So in that short period of time, so we said, okay, we've got a deal. We're going to do this. The next day, my job is to figure out how do you do it because there wasn't any application or any process in place. There was this new rule. So I called information, got the number for the SEC in Washington, D.C. I went through the receptionist and got transferred about 900 times and finally ended up speaking to somebody that knew what I was talking about. And they said, well, you actually have to, there's a process. So we got involved in that and actually got approved. And this guy, Richard Lindsay, the economist that I mentioned earlier, the last part of the approval process was going in to visit with him. And I remember I didn't have a suit because we were... No. Cox is a current chairman. His name was Richard Lindsay, and he wasn't a chairman, but he was the head of market regulation, which is the one that handles the rules for the market. So we were blue jeans and shorts at Terra Nova. So I ran. I had to go buy a suit. I went down to Washington, D.C. I sat with him, and this guy grilled me. Stuart, my partner, was there with me, and grilled me for 2 hours. I mean, there was sweat coming, and I thought, oh, for sure he's going to say no, that they're not going to let us do this. And as it turned out, one of the attorneys that worked for him said to me, you know what, he's not really trying to beat you up here. It's just everybody else that showed up. There were three other companies, came with 900 lawyers, and no one would answer a question. And so they said yes, and then we were one of four companies that got approved in the first round. So when we did it, we had no customers. So the other question after the question that Stuart had about how long, I said 8 weeks, and he goes, okay, what business? And that was a problem because we had absolutely no customers. We thought we had some potential customers, but there was a couple of requirements. One, the system needed to be all electronic, so we weren't going to build a trading floor. It needed to be fast, because that's what the demand was for immediate access to the market. And finally, you know, they say necessity is the mother of invention. We sat there scratching our heads, and I came up with this idea. I said, you know what, the way NASDAQ stock market works is if you want to buy Microsoft, it trades in 300 different places. I'm not going to go into a big market structure discussion here, but it used to trade it. Every firm traded it. There was no centralized place like an exchange floor where it traded. But the requirement on these new rules was that all these different dealers that traded Microsoft needed to publish their prices. The problem was that 300 different dealers, Microsoft could trade at 300 different prices. So the idea was, well, wait a second. What if we don't focus so much on being the center of where markets, stocks are going to trade, but we connect to all these guys? We take in all their prices, and if someone gives us an order, we don't really need the seller. We'll find it somewhere in the world, but it'll always be at the best price. And it was a simple concept, but it didn't exist. There was no technology that existed in our marketplace that would allow a customer to come in and say, I want to buy Microsoft, and oh, by the way, I want to get the best deal possible for Microsoft. So that's what we did that was different, and it was really valued by the investment community, and the business started to take off. And I guess finally, I'd mention that the name Archipelago, I didn't come up with it, Stuart Townsend did. And it was a play on one of our competitors, that there was a competitor, one of the four of us that got started, it was called The Island. And the island was a centralized marketplace. It was small. And you had to trade there. And if you went there to trade, you could get the stock there, but it didn't mean you were going to get the best price. And Stuart said, you know what? We're going to put them all together. It's a collection of islands. Let's call it Archipelago. So that's how we came up with the name. The principles of the company and our motto was, let's make money by doing the right thing. So we always live by that. So you know what? This marketplace is so closed. Everyone's an outsider. If we just do the right thing by the customers, meaning everyone, not just ones that were members of an exchange like New York, but for all investors, then we're going to have a business. And we did that. And we did that for 7 years and extremely successfully. A couple of the keys for success. Once we got this started and people started to use us more and more because it's an efficient way that we were able to, connect the markets, we were going to be so successful, but only to a degree. And as I continued to study the markets and the way things worked, I decided at one point that it would be a smart idea for us to graduate from being an ECN, but to become a full-fledged stock exchange. And a couple of reasons for that. Stock exchanges get market data revenue, and ECNs didn't. So there was a new revenue opportunity. We sell our prices as an exchange. And you charge people to list on an exchange, and ECNs don't do that. So there was the possibility that we would be a place where a company would come and list their stock. And the second area is on the expense side. We were spending, at the height, about $80 million a year to clear trades as an ECN. Well, exchanges get access to clearing for free. So there was an $80 million expense synergy by doing it, if only we could figure out how to do it. And I guess finally, everyone knew what an exchange was. I was doing speaking engagements all over the world because the ECNs were starting to become popular, and we were one of the big interesting ones. And it took an hour to explain what an ECN was, but if you just said I'm a stock exchange, that was pretty simple. So there was a brand value. As we continued to gain traction, we entered into a few. Somebody also asked me earlier, how did you know when it was time to raise money? And it was at the point where somebody started copying our business model. So it was working so well, one of the big broker-dealers copied basically our system and gave it to their customers. It was at that point that I said to my partners, listen, we need to get in bed with one of these big Wall Street broker-dealers or we're going to be dead because they're all going to copy what we're doing. So we went out and tried to raise some money, and we were very successful at it. In 1999, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan, even CNBC, who considered themselves the center of the stock market broadcasting world, which they were, invested $189 million. So it was between the seven of them. It was one of the biggest rounds of private equity financing that was done in 1999, and it was into this two-year-old company that had a name that half the people didn't know what it meant, and the other half couldn't pronounce it, but had a very good business. One of the lucky things that happened, there was one of these investors that came along was American Century, and American Century Mutual Funds, one of the most savvy, very large equity investors in the U.S. They were known, one, for being savvy, they had great returns, but being really secretive. So they didn't want to do business. They only did business with a few people. You were sworn, and at the risk of death if you ever disclosed one of the positions that they took or a position they were getting out of. I was sitting early on at ARCA in the very first year, and a phone call came in. One of the guys that worked with me answered the phone, and I was on another line, and he said, hey, there's a guy from American Century Mutual Funds that wants to talk to you. And I knew them. I mean, I had been in the business, and I thought it was a friend of mine. I thought, I didn't know who I thought it was. The guy's playing a trick on me. So he knows I'm busy, and he's going to call up and make me think that, oh, my God, American Century Mutual Funds wants to talk to you guys. So I said to Paul, would you tell Frank to leave me alone, and I don't want to talk to him. So Paul said, no, this guy says he's really from Americans. Take a number. And so he did, and then I forgot about it. A couple of days, about a week went by, and the guy called back again and said, hey, we're waiting to hear back from you. This time I did take the call, And it really was American Century Mutual Funds. And we went out to Kansas City to meet with them. And at that meeting, they said, listen, you know, by you sign this oath under, you know, the penalty of death if you ever mention one of the trades that we're doing, but we want to start doing business with you guys. So we never mentioned it, but the guy at American Century who ran the trading desk, Harold Bradley, did start to mention it. So he, you know, he went around and told people at Goldman Sachs, hey, we're using this archipelago system, and they're going to kill you guys. So it was that simple twist of fate or whatever happened happened that day that a company like Goldman Sachs got so concerned that a customer like an American Century Mutual Funds would actually do business with us, led to the point where they were the first investor, actually along with E-Trade, they both invested $25 million into what ended up being, like I said, $189 million in total raised in 1999. Then along the way, we continued to build out the business. In 2003, we did a $125 million round of invest. We took in money from General Atlantic Partners. The business had done really, really well. There was a price war that erupted. We wanted to go public. We were almost broke because of this price war. So we took in another big round of financing and then managed to turn quite a few things around. And a couple of those things, one was this idea of becoming an exchange, which shifted our economics so greatly. We took part of that $190 million and we bought the Pacific Stock Exchange that was based in San Francisco. They had two floors, actually one in LA, one in San Fran. We closed them. We used their license to gain access as an exchange. We did a couple of other investments along. We bought a large competitor. We bought a technology company. And then finally, last year, we merged with the New York Stock Exchange. The question of why become a public company, I mean, we were really familiar, and we were the first exchange in the United States to actually go public. But we were really familiar with capital raising from our experience. We spent a lot of time in, you know, doing an IPO and talking to investors. And for us, those investors that would buy our stock were actually people that would trade on our system. So there was a great branding exercise just in going public. And we were able to explain to people that, you know, we need, as an exchange, which traditionally this membership organization needs to be beholding to investors and not to members. We were profit-driven, so we were driven to innovate. We were driven to be efficient. It's the opposite of what the New York Stock Exchange was just a year ago. So we were the first. There's been others to follow, but it really was. I mean, based on our view of what our business was, we looked to diversify, get into new products, and ARCA was extremely successful at that. So leads well into the trend towards consolidation in the markets. You know, you may ask why it's taken so long for exchanges to become more global. I mean, after all, you can go to almost any country in the world. There's a McDonald's. There's financial services industry. They have been global for a long time. But there's a number of reasons why I think exchanges have lagged behind other industries. And the primary reason is that they were membership organizations. So they weren't there to be a business to generate a profit. They were there to serve the members. The second thing, exchanges are seen as national treasures, and they are. So there's a lot of nationalistic pride that goes along with having an exchange. And John Thain, I think he started pointing this out as we were going into the Euronext deal is that, you know, every country has a flag, an army, and a stock exchange. So they're really prideful in those things. And as part of that, there's a government process that you have to go through. We're a highly regulated industry, and these things are protected. So there's a big political process and regulatory process that you have to go through in order to consolidate internationally. Euronext, our new partner, which we acquired and closed last week, is the poster child for this process. They have brought together five exchanges and five regulators in the last 6 years. The trend continues in other parts of the world. Just recently, India began to allow foreign investments in their markets, and we actually bought part of the National Stock Exchange in India. So I think the competitive trend is clear. Most exchanges now are for-profit. Most of them are public companies, and they now have access to capital markets, will look to expand their business, and that's really what's driving this consolidation. Another thing that's driving the consolidation is customer demand. I mean, our customers are pulling us in this direction, because what's happened since we go back to 1994 when I started Terra Nova and everybody was on the telephone, trading, because electronic exists, have become more electronic. Brokerage firms have cut way back. We used to have NASDAQ trading desks with hundreds of people on them. Goldman, I think, now has 6 people. They used to have 300 on their NASDAQ trading desk because computers do it. So as they grew in sophistication in automating their trading system, they start to look across products. So, okay, well, we've automated NASDAQ. The next thing that they started to automate was trading New York Stock Exchange listed stocks. And then the people that trade futures, which they arbitrage against the stocks, went away, and computers started to do the arbitrage. So as this demand for the trading community to become more and more efficient, as the markets have become more efficient, drive us to trying to put more product on a single platform. For years in Europe and Asia, the U.S. was way behind. They had traded both derivatives and equities in the same marketplace. But historically, exchanges traded in the U.S. traded one or the other. Today, exchanges need to trade stocks, options, futures, everything on a single platform, and as we've led the charge in, on a global footprint. Because really what we are is, I mean, these businesses, because of the technology, are amazingly scalable. And the more opportunities for a trading interaction we charge for every transaction that's done, the more money we make. So we look to serve our broker-dealer community, which has much more of a global view today, by being a one-stop shop for trading. Let me turn to the NYSE now. The NYSE is well-positioned to better serve traders and investors by producing efficiencies, driving innovation, creating new business and revenue opportunities, and we're doing this while having to maintain the highest standards in the world for both the people that trade in our marketplace and the companies that list there. And this has happened in a really short period of time. John Thayne, who was the president of Goldman Sachs in 2003, after 25 years, left Goldman to come to the New York Stock Exchange. He was dealing with the old regime, which was Dick Grasso and this big pay scandal and regulatory oversight scandal had been tossed out of the NYSE. We had a temporary chairman, no CEO. John came in with looking, obviously having to do something and wanting to do something, but it was going to require some pretty bold moves. This was still a membership organization. It was a not-for-profit organization that had gone through tremendous turmoil. I remember when John took the job in 2004, and my initial thought was, because John was the executive at Goldman Sachs that pulled the trigger on the ARK investment in 1999, and he had followed, and I knew him a little bit over those years. But when they said he was going to, I just clicked in my head for one second. I thought, you know what, something might happen with these guys someday. But it took about a year. He called me one day and said, "Hey, would you like to come over and have lunch?" We had a discussion which led to our merger, which led to the New York Stock Exchange becoming a for-profit public company. ARCA was already public. When we did the merger, it was a reverse merger. The NYSE demutualized, so all the members gave up their seats in exchange for shares in the new company. NYSE backed itself into the Archipelago public company, and one fell swoop was able to achieve demutualization and basically an IPO. So in one short year, the New York Stock Exchange, which was a single product, they just traded stocks, merging with Archipelago got us into, or them, now us, into the trading of NASDAQ stocks. ARCA, just a few weeks ago, had an all-time record trading day. We traded 2 billion shares of U.S. equity securities. It got the New York Stock Exchange into the options business, because after we acquired the Pacific Stock Exchange, we bought the Pacific Options Exchange. It got the New York Stock Exchange in the ETF business, which is a big growing segment in the marketplace. I think most of you know what an ETF is, but ARCA has nearly 50% of the market of trading ETFs. It got us in the bond business. So we've launched a new bond platform based on the Archipelago technology, and in a couple of weeks we'll start trading 6,000 bonds, different bonds that are issued by companies that are listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And we got a new listings platform. So when I said earlier on, one of the big revenue opportunities for becoming an exchange for ARCA was to be a listings platform, we created a new listings platform for the NYSE for companies that aren't actually eligible to list on the floor. They now have an alternative where they can list on Archipelago. Without that, really, NASDAQ's the only other place that a company that doesn't meet New York standards can list. So we brought two very diverse organizations, and soon a third with Euronext in just a little bit more than a year under one roof. And so I thought about when we first did the ARCA merger and it was closed, John and I had to walk around and meet investors and traders. And the first one we're in, somebody asked the question is, how could a company that is so, I mean, we were the blue jeans and shorts and tennis shoes and New York Stock Exchange pinstripe suits and wingtip shoes could come from 214 years, or at the time 213 years of history, and merge with a seven-year-old company. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, what's, you know, John looks at me and I said, well, it's simple. We're so different. There's no point of overlap whatsoever in this organization, so it's got to work because there's no disagreement. They see it this way, we see it this way, so there's not going to be any fight over who's right and who's wrong. We're in perfect disagreement. So that actually turned out to be true. And as of today, most of the really old-timers, old-timers is the wrong way to say it, the old regime at the NYSE is pretty much gone, and it's been replaced with an entrepreneurial culture with a lot of ARCA people and new people that we've hired that view this as a business rather than what they had run for decades, which was, again, a private organization. So a brand new era of innovation comes to the NYSE. Another bold move on John's part was to reinvent the floor. So we were starting, one of the reasons for the ARCA merger was because it was challenging the NYSE trading system, and which was predominantly manual. John launched a new market structure, which was going to allow electronics to actually compete with the floor. It's called the hybrid system. At the time, the New York Stock Exchange was the most liquid equity market in the world. It had the lowest execution costs. It had all the global listings, but it was really, really slow. So the idea was to bring electronics together with the floor in a unique market structure. It took some real guts because you got to have somebody start your car every morning for you, considering how it just how it replaces people that have traditionally made their living by doing it hand to hand. So as that's happened, I don't know how familiar you all are with the way the New York Stock Exchange works, but we have a specialist model. There's one individual in every stock that they trade many stocks, but for a particular stock, there's one person that's responsible for making sure the market stays orderly. As we made the market more electronic, we had to make those specialists more electronic. There's been a lot of challenges in doing that because they did everything manual while the rest of the world was evolving. They continue to do everything by hand. So we've had to change the way they operate. We've done that, I'd say, pretty successfully. There's a lot more changes to come there, but there's a lot of upside, a huge opportunity for the organization. And some of these specialists that are really progressive have started to move to the ARCA system where they can be a specialist in stocks there electronically. So now on to Euronext. As we diversified our product offering with Archipelago, we've diversified our geographical footprint with Euronext. For those of you who aren't familiar with Euronext, I'll give you a little bit of the history. Euronext was formed in 2000 with the merger of Amsterdam, Brussels, Paris, and the Paris Exchange. In 2002, they bought Lisbon and then bought the Life Exchange, which is a big futures exchange that's based in London. Today, Euronext is the number one cash equities exchange in Europe. They list 30 of the 100 top European companies based on market cap. They're the second largest derivatives exchange in Europe, trading commodities, indices, currencies, interest rate, and interest rate futures. If you consider what the NYSE Euronext will now be able to do, now that we've concluded our merger, we'll be combining the world's two largest cash equity markets. We'll list 78 of the 100 largest companies in the world. We'll provide a new platform for global listings for thousands of rapidly growing companies worldwide. We'll diversify globally through this big, through the powerful Life Futures Exchange. We'll operate 7 exchanges in 6 countries, cover more time zones than any other exchange group, and trade in 2 of the world's largest currencies. I think one reason we'll be successful is that there's a proven track record of integration. In Europe, I mentioned that how Euronext and Jean-Francois Theodore, who's the CEO there, managed to integrate 5 markets in 5 different countries. At Archipelago, we had done a number of mergers, as I mentioned earlier, and successfully integrated them. And then Arca and the New York Stock Exchange completed a very successful merger and integration. So the integration process is underway. One of the core responsibilities for me and one of the core synergies is in technology. It's the biggest cost that we have and most exchanges have. Together, in 2005, the NYSE and Euronext spent $650 million on technology. I think it's about $450 million too much. So there's a big opportunity for us to do that. And really how we'll do that is by combining all of the trading systems into a single system. Along with consolidating, though, the technology, we still have to be respectful of the cultures in the individual countries. So we're not looking to consolidate the exchanges, just the technology platform. So each country runs under separate rules. Each country will have a unique market structure. It still allows French companies that want to list in France to do so, and Dutch companies to list there. But the real key for us is a single technology for trading all the stocks and futures and options that we trade today. We're also pursuing a broader strategy of globalization. We're building our global reach through linkages with Asia, particularly in Japan, China, and India. As I mentioned earlier, we bought 5% of the National Stock Exchange in India, which is a fabulous growing marketplace. We signed a strategic alliance with the Toronto Stock Exchange. And we're trying, and I emphasize trying, to link up with the Chinese markets. The NYSE Euronext leads the competition in listings and trading in the BRIC countries. So Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Just to put things into perspective there, our listings from BRIC countries is about 17 times that of NASDAQ. And to sum up our global vision, we're developing a new world, a new market for what is a consolidating world. Let me now just turn to the competitiveness of U.S. financial markets. The trend is disturbing for us, and it's clear companies are moving away from listing in the U.S. And the concern is obvious. I mean, it brings doubt about the competitiveness and the attractiveness of U.S. markets. And some of the stats, I mean, they're pretty telling. In the IPO front, in 2000, we listed 9 of the 10 largest IPOs in the world. In 2005, we listed 1 of the top 25 IPOs. In 2006, only 2 of the top 25 registered in the U.S. and listed with us. In terms of capital raised in 2006, the figures are as stark. The LSE, London Stock Exchange, raised $42 billion. And in their AIM marketplace, which is an alternative marketplace for smaller companies, they raised about $13 billion for a combined $53 billion. Hong Kong was second at $46 billion. We were third at $27 billion. Euronext was next at 21.1, which you can see why we have another big incentive to merge with Euronext. You put the two together and we're as big as London is again, and then followed by NASDAQ at around 18 billion. So those numbers demonstrate the growth of competitiveness of overseas markets, and you can, you know, I mentioned AIM during the past 3 years, new listings on AIM have soared from 16 in 2003 to 124 in 2006. Hong Kong's new listings increased from 46 to 56 in the same period. Most of those were Chinese companies. We were the first to raise the red flag in 2004. It's obvious we had the most to lose. And we cited four fundamental reasons. The first was Sarbanes-Oxley. And in particular, 404. As a public company ourselves, we know the burdens of 404. I mean, it costs too much. It takes too much time. It's a drag on our listed companies and the attractiveness of our markets. The second major reason is the lack of accounting convergence between the regulatory regimes across the world. European companies in particular don't see a rationale for reconciling with U.S. GAAP. Yet, if you look at it, we talked about this earlier, if you look at the numbers, they're virtually the same, regardless of whether you follow GAAP or not. So we need to overcome that. The third reason is the U.S. trial bar and a litigious environment in the U.S. Companies are afraid to come here for getting sued. I think you take everything else away, that is the one that won't go away. And, you know, the prospect for anything goes wrong at the company and you face an enormous class action lawsuit with the high cost to defend it and the potential outcome is a big, big problem. And then lastly, another contributing factor is the quality of markets abroad. I have our old general counsel. His name's Kevin O'Hara. He's now at the Chicago Board of Trade. He left ARCA after the merger, and we talked about this a lot of times. I have publicly, and he called me and said, listen, forget about all the other stuff. It's just simple. The Hong Kong market and the London Stock Exchange are extremely competitive. India is ready to get you next, so quit blaming it on Sarbanes. The fact is you can go raise, you know, $10 billion in Hong Kong if you want to, and that is a serious threat. So we are encouraged, though, on the regulatory front from some recent support from Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. Chuck Schumer and Michael Bloomberg in New York held a conference to discuss competitiveness of the New York Financial Market Center in particular. We've been working for 3 years to build a groundswell for reform, and we think we're starting to make some serious progress there. We do think the scales are tipping towards reform, and it really couldn't come at a better time for us, really, because for all, you know, we've done to transform the New York Stock Exchange, U.S. financial markets cannot win the competition for capital if our public policies chase investors and listed companies out of our marketplace. So in summary, every day our markets are becoming increasingly global and competitive. To remain on the leading edge of innovation, exchanges must continue to reinvent themselves, and I'm proud to be affiliated with the marketplace that is leading the change. So with that, I'd like to open the floor to questions. Thank you. Yes.
Do you see a time in the U.S. in the future where there's a single source of liquidity that levels the playing field?
I'd sure like to if it's us. I actually don't. We have a we'll see them shrink as through the consolidation in the U.S. We have seen more central. NASDAQ, as I mentioned earlier, had 300 different places where you could trade Microsoft. Today, there's really two. But I don't think we will. I do think we'll continue to see consolidation, but the need for competition here is so great, it exists. The barrier to entry isn't going away. So at any point where you did have one centralized marketplace, which we had a few years ago, prices tended to be high, service levels tended to be low, and I think investors suffered from that. So ultimately, I think the SEC keeps our environment pretty competitive.
I just wanted to say, if anybody has a question, we have microphones. So if you could wait until somebody comes by with a microphone and hands it to you, just put your hand up, and then we'll hand the microphone to you. So.
I'm sorry?
Do you think your actions are going to stop the decrease in the value of the American dollar versus the euro dollar?
You know, our actions actions have very little to, to do with that. So I would say no, what we're doing won't impact that. I do think, though, that what we're doing is going to impact the change, this recent trend, towards raising capital in markets outside of the U.S. Yes.
So could you explain the differential to that last point about international competitiveness? Why is India or the LSE perceived or actually cheaper than listing on the New York Stock Exchange? Is it the presumably it's not the banking fees, it might be. Is it the legal fees? Is it the annual fees that the exchanges charge? What is the differential in terms of competitiveness?
It isn't the fees, because what we charge is relatively small. I think the last company on the list eligible to list on the New York Stock Exchange in an IPO probably pays somewhere around $200,000 in a listing fee. So it's not that. It's this fear, if you come here, that one, you have to become 404 compliant, which is very expensive. It's time consuming. It's a distraction to the business. I think Sarbanes-Oxley has done a lot of great things to reform the way boards operate and put focus on an area that we had huge problems. But the implementation was wrong, because it now discourages companies, because you can actually raise money in India. You can raise money, a lot of money, in Hong Kong, that a lot of companies have said, you know what, I think I'll skip it. I'll just stay here.
I'd like to ask a question from the point of view of an investor. I recently bought a stock, a Canadian company, and the stock is listed in Toronto. When I bought it, at the end of the day, I said, well, what price did I pay? I was notified by my U.S. broker that I had two different prices, one with Canadian dollar. Now, any night that I wish to find how I did that day, or I would get two prices, the Canadian price in Toronto and the New York price with a different symbol. As you look toward decreasing that confusion and increasing the competitiveness, how do you solve this problem of the exchange, the foreign exchange rate, which is implicit in my question?
Yeah, so, well, that is the difference in the price, obviously. I mean, that's perfectly, perfectly arbitraged. And I actually think that, you know, I mean, if it's a Canadian company and you're a Canadian citizen and you transact in Canadian dollars, it's great. You can see it means, you know, the price in Canadian dollars. And if you own it here in the U.S., I mean, the translation's easier to see it in U.S. dollars. The problem is in the symbol. Right? So if you want to try and find the stock, it's not easy for you to do that. And you have to know what's a symbol in Canada, what's a symbol here in the U.S. One thing that we did, this was actually a bit of an argument. When we listed the NYSE Euronext, which last Thursday it opened for trading after we completed our merger, there was a debate about what the symbol should be, and we decided on NYX, but the Europeans wanted a different symbol. And I'm like, well, wait a second, this is completely confusing. We should have one symbol for this company. We listed this our stock as a global share, which is new and different. I think it's pretty exciting. Is you can go and buy shares in NYX or NYSE Euronext in Paris, or you can buy them in New York, and they're the same stock. So whereas the Canadian company you're talking about most likely is an ADR in the U.S., American depository receipt and is an ordinary in Canada. Our stock is the same shares, same symbol. You can trade it in euros, which is going to have a different, you know, a different euro price to it versus the dollar price, and that's the currency translation, but they're exactly the same shares. There's no there's no depository receipt that backs them. They're ordinaries trading in both markets. So I don't know if I really answered your question entirely. I mean, I am all for not confusing investors, and I think your point is, I mean, the place I go for that stock, I'd go to Yahoo, which has the price in both marketplaces, and you got to do the math on the currency translation, but I mean, they are the same, because there's any arbitrage opportunity there in that currency whatsoever, it gets taken out by the market immediately. I think you're in charge of picking who, because you've got the...
Hi, I was wondering if the NYSE merged with Euronext, and now it's a global company, and you mentioned going public, you have to deal with Sarbanes-Oxley requirements. Now, as a global company, do you have to deal with that as a whole scale? Did that scare off Euronext? How exactly does that work? Because it seems like go global, don't deal with Sarbanes-Oxley.
No, you do. You do have to deal with it because we're listed here. And there was a lot of things that almost scared off Euronext. There was each one of the regulators in Europe that was concerned about their influence and position. Because when they put Euronext together, they left the markets operate separately. They put it on one technology platform, but there's a regulator in Amsterdam, a regulator in Brussels, a regulator in Paris, and that was in where the real, which is where the real focus was. And then obviously we got to the issue of having to bear the cost of 404 compliance in the U.S., but it was more on the who runs the markets in the local country that we had to deal with. But we did have to deal with it because we're listed here.
Yeah. What are your feelings about, given the speed of execution and the integration of markets, and especially some of what we saw, I think, in February with a lot of electronic trading, do you see this sort of threatening the stability of world markets or helping the stability?
Some of my peers would argue that it's threatening because you need to have someone who's ultimately responsible for trend. In the case of the NYSE, it would be the specialists. And I debate this point with them, and they see reality. My point of view is that if you're in a crisis and the market is, and the crisis means it's plunging, nobody is having is overly concerned while it's rising rapidly, right? So it's on the downside. No one steps in to try to make the market stop going down. I mean, so it's like a currency intervention. The specialist is not sitting here saying, I've got my $10 billion of capital. I am going to lose it all to make the market stop going down. That's not their role. They would never fill that role. So there's a misconception as to what they do. General Electric, General Electric, Microsoft, IBM, Dell Computer, there's no difference. There's no specialist in those stocks in the NASDAQ marketplace. There is in the New York marketplace, but they trade like water. They trade very well electronically. They're very thick, deep markets. So they take care of themselves. It's the other companies that aren't the Dells of the world that need some help. And it's not in the crisis time because no one stops it when the whole world's falling apart because they don't have enough money to. But in day-to-day trading, there's not always a buyer and a seller showing up in the stock at the same time. So in our marketplace with the specialists, they fill in. So someone says, you know, I want to buy 2,000 shares of stock. There's none for sale. We have somebody that fills in. In NASDAQ, sometimes the stock moves. You know, you had a $20 stock that moves $10 by mistake. Because no one was there. That's the danger in that marketplace. So I think we've struck a great balance here between having someone be responsible for orderly trading in normal market conditions relative to NASDAQ. But in markets as a whole, in times of crisis, there's no one. It's going down. That is different. Now, that wasn't, just for the record, that wasn't our glitch. We have our own glitches, but that was Dow Jones miscalculated the price of the index. And that didn't have anything to do with electronic trading. It had to do with Dow Jones company putting in a new server farm, where they take the prices in and they calculate the price of the average. Somebody made a programming error, and they send the wrong price out. So it wasn't us. It was Dow Jones. Not to say we have our own situations, but it was someone who programmed the system to calculate the value of the average goofed up, and they sent the wrong price out. No, no, we had a problem after that. So the first problem was that Dow Jones miscalculated the price, so it's a separate company. It's owned by the Wall Street Journal. And they sent a wrong price out. When that wrong price went out, it scared the pants off of a whole bunch of people who panicked and rushed into the market. And when they did, we had a bottleneck in one part of our system, which caused the system to slow down, and that was our problem, which we're resolving. I mean, that piece of it's been resolved. My job is running tech. I'm replacing all the technology that runs the New York Stock Exchange. It's old. It's 30 years old. It's been patched on because as markets, market structure changed, rather than fixing the whole thing, they glued a new piece on and another piece. It's immensely complicated. It's extremely expensive, and it's slow as mud. We're going to replace the whole thing with a new system, which I'll be responsible for. So 9 months from now, if something goes wrong, it'll be my fault. But today, it's an old system.